I've only got one plea. I'm guilty.
Guilty. Hello, beautiful humans. I'm Tiny Castle.
And I'm Benjamin Mead.
And you're listening to Just a Minute. Just a Minute is an educational podcast where we break down justice topics in 30 minutes or less. Today's topic is, what is plea bargaining? Welcome and thanks for joining us. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Timmy. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
Yes.
Timmy, my question for you today is, first of all, how do you plead?
I plead the fifth.
You plead the fifth.
It's the only way I know how to plead.
Well, so, okay, that's an option for sure. Oh. But you haven't even heard the charges against you.
Oh.
So I was going to charge you with being a sexy and soothing podcast host. So do you still want to plead the fifth? Or are you
guilty?
Yeah.
Guilty.
What are your options for pleading? You've already said you plead the fifth.
Oh, yeah.
But that's not actually a plea in the sense of, you know, when the judge asks you, how do you plead to the charges against you?
Yeah, that's just so I don't have to say anything, right? Yeah. I don't have to talk to anyone.
Right. You can plead the fifth on the stand for sure if you're, like, called to testify. Okay. You don't have to, like, testify against yourself.
Good.
But when the judge says, you've been charged with this particular crime, what are your options for responding to his, how do you plead?
It wasn't me. That's my plea. Judge, it wasn't me.
Yeah, so that would be a not guilty. Oh, so you would enter a not guilty plea. I asked my students this.
I didn't do it.
I asked my students this other day in class, like, what are your options for entering a plea? And they looked at me like, guilty and not guilty? Like, aren't you supposed to have a PhD in this? Don't you know that? So you can definitely say, it wasn't me.
Wasn't me.
Not guilty plea. You're not guilty or guilty. But there are also a couple of other options for pleas. And those include a no contest plea and an Al Ford plea.
Alfred.
Not Alfred, Batman's butler, but Alfred.
Alfred.
Yeah, but a no contest plea, or as we call it in Latin, nolo contendere. And I don't speak Latin, so I don't know if I pronounce that right or not.
It's actually pretty good. I mean, if you listen to lawyers say it, they just say nolo contendere, you know, or dare or dare. Yeah.
Right, but a nolo contendere plea or a no contest plea means that you are not pleading guilty or not guilty. You're just admitting that there's sufficient evidence against you and you're accepting the punishment.
Correct.
So you're not admitting guilt or innocence, but essentially you're saying, I'm not challenging the evidence against me.
Yes.
And a no contest plea might be helpful or might be an option for you if you want to avoid civil liability.
Correct.
So let's say that you were drunk driving and you're charged with drunk driving. You might plead no contest to that, or you were in an accident and you were drunk driving. Let's say you're in an accident.
Okay.
So you're charged with the crime of drunk driving, but the other driver that you hit, they might sue you for damages to their car or medical bills.
Yes.
And if you plead guilty in court, then your guilty plea can be admitted when they sue you in civil court as evidence against you.
Yes.
So you can enter a no contest plea, and then that will not count against you as evidence in a civil trial. Although in Virginia it does. Virginia actually allows no contest pleas to be admitted as evidence in civil trials.
Oh.
But it's not as like damaging against your case as a full blown guilty plea, but the people can use that against you in a no contest plea. So a no contest plea really is to avoid being sued. And then you have an Alford plea, and an Alford plea is named after Henry Alford, and he was charged with first-degree murder in North Carolina in 1963. There was some evidence against him, particularly he was seen arguing with the victim, you know, in the immediate hours preceding the murder, and he was eligible for the death penalty. And basically, he pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and was sentenced to 30 years in prison. But all the time, he declared his innocence. So he basically said, I'm innocent. I did not do this crime, but I'm pleading guilty to avoid the death penalty.
Gotcha.
And the Supreme Court has upheld Alford plea so long as the person who's pleading guilty does so knowingly. They've been advised by an attorney and are willing to accept that there's, you know, strong evidence against them. But an Alford plea is different from a no contest plea, because no contest plea, you're not admitting anything either way. But an Alford plea, you're saying, I'm innocent. I did not do this, but I'm going to plead guilty so I don't get a harsher punishment.
So you might enter an Alford plea if, in fact, the owl did it, except that there's a lot of evidence against you.
Mm-hmm.
but it's really the owl.
So I didn't watch the
staircase.
The staircase. But did he actually enter an Alford plea?
Yes, he ends up entering an Alford plea.
My second question for you, and this is like a serious. I want to hear your thoughts on this.
Okay.
Would you personally ever plead guilty to a crime that you didn't commit?
Absolutely.
You would?
Yes.
I would too.
Yes.
But like, why would you do that? Why would you plead guilty if you were innocent?
Because I study the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why people are trying, you know, there's a reason why there's a change in terminology and people are saying things like criminal legal system these days instead of criminal justice system.
Yeah.
And I know if there's a lot of evidence against me, it might be my best bet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this often comes up where somebody says, I would never plead guilty if I were innocent. Mm-hmm. Yes, you would. If you were in an interrogation room long enough and you know, like there are lots of reasons, but yeah, absolutely. I would, even if I was innocent, if I thought I'd get a lesser charge and it looked like it was not going my way.
Yeah, me too. I'm like super risk averse. I don't like buy lottery tickets. And in my like retirement package, I pick like the lowest investment risk because I don't want to risk losing my money.
Yeah.
So absolutely. If I was, you know, if I was innocent and I could choose between like definitely serving 5 years in prison or gambling going to trial and, you know, betting on whether I'm going to get off scot-free or go to prison for 30 years, I'm going to take the safe five. Yes. I'm not going to risk 30.
Yeah.
30 or nothing.
Agreed.
And the thing or the process that allows that to happen is called plea bargaining.
Yes.
So plea bargaining is when a defendant agrees to plead guilty and avoid a trial in exchange for certain concessions from the prosecutor. And of course, the prosecutor, he's the individual or she's the individual or they're the individual in criminal court system who files the charges, who decides what crimes people get charged with.
Very important person.
Yes. And they're also responsible for proving in court that the person that they're charging committed the crimes that they're charging them with.
On the state's behalf.
Mm-hmm. Right. So prosecutor is the chief law enforcement officer in the district, is responsible for bringing charges and proving those charges.
Yes.
So there are a number of options that prosecutors can employ when they offer plea bargains. Mm-hmm. One is a charge bargain, and a charge bargain is when a prosecutor reduces or alters the charges against you. So let's say that you're charged with a felony assault against a police officer. Mm-hmm. The prosecutor can say, okay, you know, it's a felony, but if you plead guilty, we'll drop that to a misdemeanor assault charge.
Right.
So you get a lower charge. Prosecutors can also alter facts or offer a fact bargain, and that's where they kind of negotiate with the facts of the crime that you're charged with. So this might be something like the prosecutor says, okay, you were caught in, you know, possession of like 50 grams, and I don't know how much a gram is or how much drugs is, so I don't know if that's a lot or a little.
I think that's a lot.
Yeah. So, well, let me drop it down. Let's say you're caught with like 10 or 15 grams of cocaine, and the prosecutor says, well, we'll just charge you with 15 grams. You still get the same crime, but like the quantity.
Yeah.
Or maybe you broke into a house and you had a gun, so having a gun kind of increases the penalty and is a fact. So the prosecutor says, we're not going to charge you with having a gun for burglary.
Yes.
There are also rights bargains where you know, you waive certain of your rights in order to accept a plea bargain. So many will include like the waiver of a right to an appeal. You plead guilty, you can't appeal that. Or you waive your right to ineffective counsel. So you can't accept a plea bargain and then go back and say like, well, I didn't have adequate representation.
Right.
So a lot of reasons, a lot of times plea bargains are kind of irreversible. You plead guilty, that's the end of the story.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, big time. And then ultimately, the one that we're probably most familiar with is the sentence bargain, where you agree to plead guilty and the prosecutor recommends a lighter or a more lenient sentence.
Yes, that's what we would be hoping for if we had decided to do that.
Right, exactly. And it's easy to see the value of plea bargaining.
Yes.
So it saves time and money. Trials are super expensive and super time consuming for everybody, the actors involved, and for the tax paying public. Super expensive, super time consuming. It allows people who committed crime to receive lighter punishments.
Yes.
And also we might think of it as kind of like negotiated justice. So everyone involved reaches a compromise. No one is happy with the outcome. It's a deal everyone can live with.
Yeah.
But plea bargaining actually doesn't have a super long history in the U.S. It really wasn't until like the early 70s when the Supreme Court said, okay, yeah, this is okay for people to do. It's constitutional to, plea bargain in exchange for a lighter sentence. And since then, plea bargaining has become an increasingly central component of the criminal justice system.
Yeah, I guess I didn't realize it was that recent.
I didn't either until, I started doing the research for this.
I think it's because it's based on, the English summary trial, which is the common law system that we adopted. But I guess it wasn't, codified in the way that we think of it.
Yeah, as I was reading, there was, serious controversies. There were lawyers who were saying, no, absolutely, this is, unconstitutional. And ultimately, in, the 70s, the Supreme Court said, yeah, this is fine. And then ever since then, it's kind of
good to go.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And ultimately now we see that, upwards of 95%, some estimates even say 98% of criminal cases are resolved through guilty pleas.
Yes.
And most of those are plea bargaining. So some people will straight up plea guilty, but a lot of those are plea bargains.
Right.
And I want to take a moment to, kind of a little side tangent here, but that statistic alone kind of counters the popular notion that guilty people are walking free all the time out of the courthouse because of legal technicalities.
Yes.
And, 95-98% of them do not. They plead guilty or accept a plea bargain.
Well, no one says that who knows anything about our justice system.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. And even when we look at that, 2-3% of people who go to trial, and again, there are different estimates, but, conviction rates are anywhere from 65-80%. So,
it's a roll of the dice.
Yeah. 95-98% of people plead guilty. 70-80% of those who go to trial get convicted. So,
the odds are not in your favor.
Yeah, it absolutely isn't. And I think that perception is kind of largely driven by celebrity cases. The public sees people Robert Blake and O.J. Simpson and Michael Jackson getting off for their crimes and think that this happens all the time. It happens to rich celebrities.
Yes.
Quite frequently.
Yes.
But the average person
does not.
Once the system kind of gets its claws in you, gets its hooks in you, it's not. It's not letting go. So this notion.
Once the owl gets its talons.
the owl is going to get you.
You will not understand this joke unless you watch The Staircase. There's a theory that the owl committed this murder, but I encourage our listeners to look it up. Okay, sorry.
No, you're good. You're good. So essentially at this point in history, at this point in time, plea bargaining is the criminal justice system.
Right, right.
It's what happens, every day. It's the dominant modal experience of criminal justice.
Yes.
And we're tempted to think of our system as adversarial, and certainly when we go to trial, we have what we refer to as an adversarial system, where we think of the prosecutor and the defense attorney as adversaries or enemies, and this is one of the reasons why courtroom dramas make such good TVs, because it's set up like a competition.
Yeah. Law and order.
Yeah, the prosecutor and the defense attorney
going out
locked in this epic struggle for truth and justice and facts.
But
legal scholars have actually referred to our system more as a courtroom work group, or it's called the courts as communities theory. And it says that prosecutors and defense attorneys, they aren't enemies, they aren't adversaries, but they're co-workers.
Yes. They work together.
pick up their briefcase and they walk into the office, into the courtroom, and they work together to achieve justice to a degree, but more primarily case processing.
Yeah,
efficiency.
Absolutely.
Let's work together. Let's strike a deal, particularly through plea bargaining, and, get through our docket, get these cases processed.
Yeah.
And certainly justice may be a component of that, but it's largely about working together to move cases quickly and efficiently through the system.
Yes. So why is this a justice issue, or what are some of the concerns that we have with plea bargaining if it makes up most of what we do?
Well, as already both of us have clearly indicated, we would plead guilty to a crime that we didn't commit.
We would.
So plea bargaining is coercive. As an example of another example of this, this is a little trick that I pull on my class when we talk about plea bargains and false confessions.
Yeah.
So on the day that I have this discussion, I always have a homework assignment due.
Uh-huh.
And so I'll come in at the beginning of class and I put on my scary stern face and say, I've looked at your homework assignments and there's multiple instances of plagiarism, and I'm going to give you the option. You can admit to plagiarizing on your homework.
Yes.
And if you do, I'm going to give you a 0 for the assignment and that will be it. But if you don't admit to plagiarism and you did, then we're going to honor court. I'm going to, pursue the full extent of my charges against you.
Yes.
And then, I mean, it's always fun because, like,
are they scared?
Yeah, they're cowering in their seats and their eyes are as big as saucers. And then I say, just kidding, just kidding. Now let's talk about plea bargaining and false confessions.
Yeah.
And usually about half of the class is like, I don't think that I plagiarized, but I was definitely going to admit it. So, you know, short span of a few minutes, I can basically get half of my class to agree to admitting to something that
and
they
cause a couple of panic attacks while you're at it, maybe.
And plagiarism, plagiarism is a little different because you can kind of confuse students about, well, I don't think that I did, but I might have. Well,
it's gray.
I mean, it's not kind of, it may not be generalizable to like committing murder or something along those lines. But the process is still coercive. It can coerce innocent people into pleading guilty, as we've indicated. Both of us would do that. And it can coerce guilty people into pleading guilty. And one of the problems with plea bargaining is particularly, scholars argue that the bargaining process is heavily stacked in favor of the prosecutor, that prosecutors have a lot of power and a lot of discretion.
Yes.
The prosecutorial charging decision is the most unreviewed decision point, and I would argue the most powerful decision point in the criminal justice system. And I say it that way because He-Man was my first fandom. When I was a kid, my mom used to dress me in like Oshkosh Bagosh overalls.
Definitely the 80s.
Yeah, and I had my He-Man sword, and I would put it in the back of my overalls like a sheath, and it didn't matter if we were in the grocery store or on the street, just wherever the urge hit me, I would draw forth my magic sword and say, by the power of Grayskull. So that's why I said prosecutors are the most powerful in the criminal justice system.
Okay, well, that's cute. Yeah. You want to know what? I was bullied in elementary school and they called me Castle Grayskull, and that was supposed to be an insult. And I was like, that doesn't even make sense.
No, Castle Grayskull is awesome.
Yeah.
It looks cool. It has super magical powers. I'd be like, thank you.
Kids these days, I don't think are going to get the reference for He-Man. Maybe. I don't know. They remade it.
There's a bunch of new Netflix shows about He-Man. So maybe they call it.
And nostalgia for 80s cartoons.
Mm-hmm. But back to prosecutorial power.
Yeah.
more recent changes in sentencing laws over the last couple of decades have actually increased prosecutorial power. So things like sentencing guidelines, mandatory minimums, three strikes, all of those are very powerful cards in a prosecutor's hand that they can use to coerce a guilty plea. So you're charged with this crime. It's a mandatory minimum. If you plead guilty, I'll drop the mandatory minimum. Or maybe it's your third strike.
Yeah.
In some states, this differs state by state, prosecutors actually have the discretion to like charge a crime as a strike or not. It's up to the prosecutor. It can be the same objective charge, but it's up to the prosecutor whether it counts as a strike or not.
That's a lot of power.
Yeah. And so these can be very effective tools in the prosecutor's toolbox to kind of negotiate plea bargains. Prosecutors can use mandatory minimums and other, charging decisions to kind of stack charges or overcharge defendants in terms of like keeping the plea bargaining process in mind. In one of the things that I'll mention about those like sentencing laws, one of the big pushes behind them was to take discretion away from judges in sentencing.
Right. Like the variability in sentences from judges for the exact same crime.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have always argued that discretion or power in the system is like mass or matter, that scientific law of mass conservation, that mass is neither created nor destroyed. It simply changes form.
Yes.
So we took that power, that discretion away from judges, and it didn't just disappear into the ether of the criminal justice system. It went somewhere else, and that, I argue, it goes to the prosecutor. Prosecutors have...
That's a good visual.
Yeah. The visual, like, I was like waving my hands and sprinkling magic dust into the ether.
Yes.
And so prosecutors have a lot of power. Defense attorneys have very little leverage in plea bargaining other than threatening to go to trial.
Yes.
In, particularly in concern to justice, plea bargains can be particularly coercive for poor defendants, for
imagine
people who
that.
Don't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, poor defendants can't afford their own attorney, so they have to have, appointed counsel or public defenders. And we're intimately familiar with caseload differences and public defenders are overworked. It's not unusual for a single public defender to have 100 or more serious cases per year.
Yeah.
A Louisiana study of public defenders in 2017 calculated the number of hours, basically, that each crime type should take, the number of hours an attorney should spend on each crime type, and how many public defenders were employed in Louisiana. It was like 363. And basically, they found that, you know, for the caseload and the number of hours required to give each case the needed attention, that Louisiana would need to hire 1,400 more attorneys.
Yeah. I have friends who are public defenders, and they're salt of the earth people that are just overworked and burned out. But their heart's in the right place, which is the reason why they became a public defender.
Absolutely. You know, and I'm always careful to qualify that. Like, this is not a critique of people who do public defense. It's just, you know, what we ask them to do is impossible.
Right.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
And then, you know, added to that, public defenders are more integrated into the courtroom work group. Usually they have offices in the courthouse beside the prosecutor. They're public servants. So they may put more pressure on their clients to plead guilty. Yeah. Also, pretrial detention is also frequently used as a bargaining chip. So people that are locked up in jail before their trial and they can't afford bail, they can't afford to bail themselves out, that can also be something that prosecutors can use to coerce a plea bargain. So you're locked up in jail. If you plead guilty, you can go home today. So it's coercive.
Yeah.
Also, this is a little bit more of kind of an abstract legal moral argument, but legal scholars say that the plea bargaining system sets up a trial penalty, or it establishes a system where that if you exercise your Sixth Amendment right to a trial by a jury of your peers, then you're going to be penalized more heavily than if you plead guilty and waive that right. So essentially it creates a penalty for exercising your constitutional right. In theory, and I'm saying this in air quotes, judges are supposed to review plea bargains and determine if they are, you know, like coercive, or if the defendant, you know, pled guilty. But in my, you know, time observing these, it's just like this rote script that judges read.
Right.
And people answer yes to it all the time. And it's just kind of this formal bureaucratic process and not any real scrutiny of plea deals. And
well, that
the
being
process.
Said, I will not name the court nor the judge, but I did sit in a trial where the judge was asleep for most of it on this.
You can't do much scrutiny of plea deals. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
So in particular, lack of review and oversight of prosecutorial decisions in charging particularly. And then also, you know, some critics of plea bargain argue that it's reduced justice, so that it is letting, you know, offenders off lightly for their crimes. So, for example, there's a lot of controversy about plea bargaining with sex offenders.
That,
you know, sex offenders can plead to like an assault instead of a rape charge as part of a plea bargain, or they may not have to register on the sex offender registry as part of a plea bargain.
Yes.
So lots of
okay. Well, so the pros are saves time and money.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do that, but pretty hefty cons to plea bargaining when it comes to justice.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do about problems with plea bargaining?
Well, first of all, there are arguments to abolish plea bargaining. Kind of proponents of plea bargaining, though, argue that the criminal justice system would collapse if every case had to go to trial. The system probably could accommodate. Many people plead guilty already without bargaining. I think, you know, abolishing plea bargaining would also encourage prosecutors to be more selective about filing charges and pursuing crimes. A lot of this, you know, 95% of plea bargains are kind of like low-level minor offenses, drug possessions, and those types of things that, you know, prosecutors could focus their effort on more serious offenses. You know, it might also increase the use of bench trials. So perhaps there are alternatives to having plea bargaining as a part of the system. In 2023, the American Bar Association Plea Bargaining Task Force released a report with 14 principles to make the plea bargaining system more fair. And without kind of reading all,
please don't.
14 of those
for
are
our
just
listeners.
You know, highlight them briefly. But that report, we will link it in the show notes. So
yes,
if you want to check
that
out, you can.
Yes, we will.
But you know, obviously, one of the big ones is reduce the power of prosecutors. Coerce guilty pleas. Prosecutors shouldn't overcharge. They should never. This is one of the recommendations. Never use pretrial detention as a factor in plea bargains and should not waive certain rights. Prosecutors should also turn over discovery prior to plea negotiations and give the parties ample time to review the evidence in the case against them. And, of course, should ensure that defendants know the collateral consequences of pleading guilty. So oftentimes they're, you know, what correctional scholars called, you know, invisible punishments.
Yes.
Like you can't get government assistance, you can't live in public housing, you can't vote, and all of these may be consequences of pleading guilty that people may not fully recognize or understand.
Yes.
Another group of principles were about, you know, getting effective counsel. Counsel should have time to review the bargain, the opportunity to investigate the case. There was also some, you know, recommendations that the sentencing difference between plea bargains and trial should be reduced. That you know, if you plead guilty, you should not get a substantially reduced sentence than what you would get if you would go to court. So kind of like decrease the gap, the disparity between you know, plea bargain sentences and trial sentences. And then, of course, more oversight and review, having the negotiation process documented and presented to judge, including all of the offers, potential offers from both sides, more judicial scrutiny and publishing data on plea bargains.
Yeah. Maybe make sure the process is fair, but would our system come to a standstill if we did this? That's a good question.
I mean, we would have to accommodate. I think we would have to accommodate for sure. And maybe those accommodations would create a more fair system.
Yeah, we could adopt a system like the Netherlands where they have, like, you know, maybe 100 trials in one day.
Yeah, that seems crazy compared to what we think of our criminal justice
system. Yeah, because in our mind, the trial is the adversarial process where you go through all of those pieces and it takes forever.
All right, to close our show, it's our Minute to Spin It, where we each give our 30-second takeaway from today's show. So, Timey, in just a minute, what's your spin?
My spin today is plead the fifth, but don't plead guilty unless you actually are.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Ben, what's your spin?
Well, as the band Alabama would say, I've only got one plea. I'm guilty.
Guilty.
Oh, nice. Of love in the first degree. So we need to be very careful about plea bargaining.
Yes.
Ensure that plea bargains are fair and are not coercive. Saving time and money is a good thing, but not at the cost of justice.
This podcast is sponsored by the Gandhi Center at JMU, which relies on support from generous donors like yourselves. If you would like to throw a few bucks to the Gandhi Center to support our educational programming, please click on the link in our show notes. Send justice topic suggestions via DM on IG at Gandhi Center JMU, or you can tweet at us or DM us on Twitter at Just A Minute Pod.